From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Yesterday, President Obama said American cooperation with the Egyptian government cannot continue when civilians are being killed in the streets.
Going forward, I've asked my national security team to assess the implications of the actions taken by the interim government.
Rebecca Cruz and I are joined by incoming University of Oklahoma Middle East scholar Samer Shahata.
Each side dehumanizes the other, and the conception of what reality is and what truth is so out of line that there are really two Egypts now.
And later, I'll talk with Peter Weinberger about building trust between ethnic, religious, and tribal groups after war and conflict.
The role of those of us who are involved in what we call peace building is to try to create some shared experiences.
Divided societies and post-conflict reconstruction. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Joining Rebecca and me in the studio today is Professor Samer Shahata. Welcome, first of all, Samer, to the University of Oklahoma.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Samer, you're from Egypt, but you're also an expert on Egyptian politics, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so clearly your phone has been ringing off the hook. What is going on right now in Egypt? The news is, to many of us over here, quite startling. It's very concerning, the level of violence, the deaths, hundreds of people dead, thousands injured, and the government, the interim government, has used very heavy hand here. So what are we to make of this?
Well, it is incredibly unfortunate and grotesque, the level of violence that's been used against the protesters. At the same time, we've known now for about a week and a half that some attempt was going to be made to remove the protesters. The cabinet approved that measure several weeks ago. And unfortunately, the history of the Egyptian security forces are such that they are incredibly heavy-handed. They have always been. There's been no change in that since Mubarak was ousted. This is the only security forces I know of in the world that when rocks are thrown at them, they pick up the rocks and throw them back at the protesters. They don't seem to have a sense of when lethal force is required and when it's not required. And unfortunately, we're seeing the same type of lying discourse that we saw under the Mubarak regime. So, for example, there has been the denial that they've used live ammunition. And of course, that falls, you know, in the face of what we're seeing.
Well, the international response to this has been pretty stark. A lot of criticism of this response, and the United States is no different. President Obama came out yesterday pretty harshly criticizing the military.
As a result, this morning we notified the Egyptian government that we are canceling our biannual joint military exercise, which was scheduled for next month.
He also responded to kind of the blame game that's been charged against the United States by both sides.
That kind of approach will do nothing to help Egyptians achieve the future that they deserve. We want Egypt to succeed. We want a peaceful, democratic, prosperous Egypt. That's our interest. But to achieve that, the Egyptians are going to have to do the work.
Just curious what your response to his speech yesterday was.
Well, it was necessary, and in some sense, it was the least that President Obama could do. I mean, Bright Star exercises are biannual military exercises. Sometimes they involve more than the United States and Egypt, other countries like Jordan and so on. And of course, it would be unfathomable for U.S. military forces to participate in joint exercises next month after the Egyptian security forces and military so brutally repressed these protests and ended up, you know, killing 500 plus people. So at the same time, that isn't terribly costly for the United States or for the Egyptian military. I think the larger questions, the more important questions are, will U.S. military assistance to Egypt, which is on the tune of $1.3 billion annually, will that be suspended or ended? And then what will the character of the relationship be from now on? Will the United States assist in Egypt's attempt to receive an IMF loan? Very important, not only for the money itself, but for what that signals to the international economic community in terms of doing business in Egypt, and the character of the relationship from now going forward.
I think what is particularly interesting to me is, what is the response within Egypt? How, I mean, this is a big country. It's a lot of people, millions, tens of millions of people live in this country. What has been the response among Egyptians about this kind of violence being used in their country? Are they comfortable with this? Are they uncomfortable? Are they likely to come out against it? Where are they headed?
Well, this is also, I think, incredibly concerning, because if you are watching Egyptian television, for example, you are seeing on the bottom of the screen in Arabic constantly there a war against terrorism. And there's also a kind of rah-rah attitude among some of the private television stations supporting the military. And there's a discourse that this was necessary and inevitable. And not only that, that the Muslim Brotherhood is a fascist organization, that these are terrorists, that there were weapons in the sit-ins. And to be a completely fair and neutral, there were weapons in the sit-ins. There were some, but certainly the vast majority of the protesters were unarmed civilians and so on. And so there is this discourse that justifies what has occurred, and it's part of the incredible polarization that has taken place in Egypt over the last month and a half. And this is why it's particularly worrying, because each side dehumanizes the other. And the conception of what reality is and what truth is so out of line that there are really two Egypts now.
Well, the vice president, the current or interim vice president, has stepped down, gave his resignation in response to this, and yet his approval ratings have decreased, perhaps speaking to your comment about the justification there. Some people have also pointed out that this is perhaps heading to civil war. They've been saying that for quite some time. Is that where we're going?
I don't think so. And there's several reasons why I don't think we're going to civil war, understood in its traditional sense. One, the conflict is a political conflict. It's not a sectarian or a religious conflict largely. You know, this is a question of ideology and so on. And secondly, Egypt doesn't have the same history of political violence as countries such as Algeria or Yemen or even Syria and so on. And the Muslim Brotherhood has faced repression in the past. So I don't think we're going to see a full-out civil war as we're seeing in Syria right now. However, it's quite likely that we are going to see instability, and we're going to see some forms of political violence, as we have seen in the last month and a half. I mean, the amount of violence, attacks against military security forces, police stations, particularly in the Sinai, over the last month and a half has skyrocketed, and we're likely to see that continue.
Well, Samarin, thank you so much for being with us today to help us try and make some sense of what we're seeing in Egypt. And I'm sure that you will be back with us again sometime soon. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. Write to us at worldviews@ou.edu or send us a tweet at worldviewsKGOU. Coming up, I'll talk with Peter Weinberger from the United States Institute of Peace. He's a specialist on divided societies who works to bridge those gaps during the reconstruction process after conflict and war. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. My guest, Peter Weinberger, is a senior program officer at the United States Institute of Peace. He focuses on post-conflict peacebuilding in divided societies and has worked with non-governmental organizations in Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and the Middle East. He's also written extensively on defense industry outsourcing and international private security. Before joining the USIP, he taught courses at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. Peter Weinberger, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
So as a senior program officer at the U.S. Institute of Peace, much of your work focuses on ethnic, religious conflict, divided societies, how to rebuild societies in post-conflict spaces. What, first of all, kind of drew you to work on issues of violence and conflict, and what are some of the most striking things that you really deal with in that area?
My focus at the USIP Academy is on working with religious, ethnic, and tribal groups when rebuilding countries after war and conflict. A lot of people who work in a post-conflict environment will say things like, I'm a specialist on rule of law, for example, writing constitutions, or I'm actually an expert on something, a functional thing, like training police forces, for example, or, in other words, might be working on rebuilding the physical infrastructure of a country after war and conflict. And often I'm told things like, I don't really care about these what we call identity-based differences, religious, ethnic, or tribal differences. I have a real specific task. That's not really part of my job. And what I always try to convey to my students is, I'm not expecting you to become an expert in this subject, but you have to understand that in countries that are what we call divided societies, where these aspects of identity are really salient and are what are causing a lot of conflict between people, we have to be aware that it affects all aspects of rebuilding countries after war and conflict, what is broadly known as peace building. I got into this particular field, which is sort of conflict resolution and applied peace work, after having worked on the ground in a few places like Israel and the Palestinian territories, Bosnia in the Western Balkans, Northern Ireland. And I had noticed a lot of commonalities between these countries, which were very different in terms of religion, identity, ethnicity. But I started to notice broad threads that were linking them. And that drew me to the work of the United States Institute of Peace, which is really perhaps the most respected in the world for this kind of applied work. And when I found out that the Institute was going to start a school for professionals, I decided to leave my last position, which was as a professor, and take on this new aspect of teaching.
So when you talk about the commonalities that you noticed in some of these very diverse locations, what are some of those commonalities? What are some of the primary obstacles, I guess, to resolving conflict or to reconciling divided societies in a post-conflict space?
Well, there are no modular solutions or what we call cookie-cutter approaches. And an analogy that I like to sometimes talk about is if you went to a doctor, a medical professional, and she or he told you, I do the same thing with each patient, I think most people would be running for the door. But at the same time, if you met a doctor and she or he told you, you know, I have a lot of experience, I've worked a lot of patients, and that's a good thing. So, you know, one can never really overly generalize about countries and cultures, which are vastly different, but one can try. So one of the things that we focus on are things like trauma. When we talk about trauma here in the United States, people are familiar with things like PTSD, post-traumatic stress. But in a lot of the countries that I am working on and my colleagues are working on, we're dealing with what we call intergenerational trauma. We've seen this to some extent in countries like the United States. If we're looking at marginalized communities, for example, ethnic minority communities. But in these societies, in a global setting, it's slightly different. If people have survived ethnic cleansing or attempts to exterminate them through genocide, this does not simply go away after the initial act has come to cessation. And it manifests over the second and third generations and all sorts of collective fears of the other community, for example, and fear of annihilation. And so if you look at a lot of countries in the world where there's protracted conflict, this is often the case. So you have intergenerational trauma, and it often occurs in more than one community. Another thing that we see are what we might call overlapping or parallel realities or parallel narratives. Most people understand the word narrative to mean a story. Or, for example, if you apply for a job, they might say, give us a narrative statement talking about yourself. But here when we talk about narratives, we're really talking about a people's fundamental worldview, a kind of understanding of how reality has unfolded. And that can relate to a trauma. But what we see in a lot of divided societies is that you have two peoples with completely parallel realities and parallel narratives. So there's a core disagreement about some event that may have occurred 65 years ago or 100 years ago or 300 years ago. And this core disagreement really filters into everyday life. So people can't agree what happened about the main reason they have conflict, and this affects something that happened a day ago or a week ago or 3 weeks ago. As an outsider who are trying to help, it can be confusing and be difficult because it's difficult to tell what has actually happened and what is happening. If you think of two circles that are overlapping, and sort of one circle is one group of people's worldview and another circle is the others, where they overlap, there's a commonality. So if I was, for example, a counselor, a marriage counselor, and two spouses came and they told me two different views, two different stories of what happened, where they overlap is the commonality, and I can build on that to try to build trust. The problem or the issue that we face is there's often no overlap. So the role of those of us who are involved in what we call peace building is to try to create an overlap, to create some shared experiences. If people's core identities are so divergent, then we often try to build a secondary identity. That could be an identity as parents, as women, as for example, as grieving members of family, as professionals, for example, teachers, environmental engineers, and to use those secondary identities to build what we might call zones of agreement or areas of cooperation to slowly begin the path of reconstruction, not only physical reconstruction, but what's called social reconstruction, which is much harder and much more difficult.
My guest is Peter Weinberger, a faculty member in the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We'll talk more right after this short break. I'm Suzette Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm talking with Peter Weinberger, a senior program officer at the United States Institute of Peace and an expert on peacebuilding in divided societies after war and conflict. When we left off, he described his work creating overlap and shared experiences between ethnic, religious, and tribal groups to make the process of both physical and social reconstruction much easier. So on that note about social reconstruction, so peace building is obviously goes well beyond ending the violence and rebuilding society physically, let's say, and engaging in, let's say, police training and establishing institutions for good governance. But it is a process by which we encourage and facilitate truth-telling, forgiveness, reconciliation. Are those the kinds of things that that you refer to when you talk about building trust and social reconstruction?
Those are definitely a part of the process, but it is layered and exceedingly complex. For example, sometimes we can talk about functional trust, meaning that two communities may agree to cooperate over issues of infrastructure, sharing electricity, for example, clean water, because there's no alternative. At the same time, they can come to no agreement on a shared educational curriculum beyond some things like math and science because they don't agree on history. When we're talking about issues of reconciliation, that's also something that we have to be careful about, the language that we use. The field of conflict resolution is not a neutral field in the sense that a lot of the ideas are influenced by Western philosophy and religious traditions, particularly Christianity. And when we talk about reconciliation, for example, this has, even amongst practitioners of international affairs who may be themselves secular, are not aware that this has some Christian overtones. And so if we're talking about truth and reconciliation, for example, in many societies, this is understood differently. That's not to say that they don't have these values in a Buddhist majority or a Muslim majority setting, but they understand it differently. I have colleagues who work on rule of law issues, for example, helping to write constitutions and come up with new legal structures after war and conflict. And they faced a situation where they discussed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Nepal, which is a country in South Asia, and had civil conflict for many years. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is an idea that was adopted in South Africa after the end of apartheid in 1994. It's the idea that you have an informal or a formal, in some instances, a tribunal of respected individuals who listen to people discuss about crimes that were committed during the course of a conflict. And in so doing, they may receive a pardon or a reduced sentence. The idea by talking about what they've done is to get everything out on the table and allows the country to heal. It's a good idea in practice, but when my colleagues suggested it in the context of Nepal, they were told, They were told, why should we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? We're a Hindu-majority country. Our culture and religious ideas are based in Hinduism. We believe in karma. We don't believe in reconciliation. This is a Christian idea. So we were able to help them. It was about reframing what was done to fit the local people's cultural understanding. But the point is, it's not simply a rebranding issue in terms of coming up with a new name. It is about working with local partners who want your help, but also making sure that local resources and actual functional resources working on the ground, but also people's culture and identity are understood and are part and parcel of the process of healing.
So could you share with us some examples of successful peace building? I mean, just the places you mentioned that you've been doing work, Israel-Palestine, Bosnia, Northern Ireland. Israel-Palestine, I don't know that we would put that in the success category, would we? But what about Bosnia? What about Northern Ireland? Are these successful cases of peace building?
It has to be success with an asterisk, in the sense that there may not have been violence for many years, but there was a prolonged conflict. There continues in some instances to be intergenerational trauma. And many people don't necessarily believe that the country is operating in what we would call a healthy way. Normal is, of course, a relative term. But, for example, I have been in Northern Ireland and in the capital city, Belfast. It's still largely segregated by sectarian or religious identity. And I've been told by people, for example, I don't want to live with the other people. I don't want my children to go to school with the other people. But I don't think we should go back to the way it was in the past. And I think our leaders should continue to negotiate with their leaders. I'll never agree with their narrative. They don't use that term, but that's essentially what they're saying. I never agree with their view of the world, but I don't feel threatened by it anymore. This, in some sense, is moving forward. It creates new problems. It creates new difficulties, but it makes an opportunity space whereby communities can try to find new ways to move forward.
Well, Dr. Weinberger, obviously peace building will remain a challenge, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. But we thank you for joining us on Worldviews to talk about some of the possible strategies. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Peter Weinberger, a senior program officer at the United States Institute of Peace. If you missed any part of this interview, we have an archive of this episode and all of our past programs on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Hallie Arias is our digital content intern, and the show is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Samer Shahata, I'm Suzette Grelott.